Good morning, gentlemen.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, Hezzy. How are you?
That's what it's all about, and what they really think, and they are none other than Professor Jeff Swartz and Professor Brendan Beery, and both of them are at the WMU Cooley, Tampa, Florida Law Professor School. That's where they teach. So good morning, gentlemen. I'm sorry for the last minute call in. I had some trouble dialing in. How you doing, guys?
Good morning, Hezzy.
Good morning, Hezzy. How you doing? You feeling better?
Thank God, yes. Very, very good. Very good.
I'm glad.
There's always something exciting about the Constitution. Why is that? I thought it was a static thing. But it's a living, breathing thing. It changes all the time.
Yes, it does. And in fact, a lot of things change all the time. And I think that that's important. I think that's part of the brilliance of the document, that it isn't a firm set of rules. It is, it's actually, for lack of a better way to put it, a set of guidelines. And we operate off of those guidelines and establish our rules based upon those guidelines. That's kind of the way I look at it. It's kind of a simplistic look. That's kind of the way I look at it.
Yeah, but it's also complex in its simplicity. I don't know if that sounds weird, but it makes sense to me. Well, gentlemen, what are you going to be discussing today?
Well, starting off with our usual, what do I really think? I usually go after long, low-hanging fruit, like Ron Johnson or Marco Rubio or Brussels sprouts. But
I love Brussels sprouts.
Yeah, I know you do. Marilyn told me to tell you she really loves you.
Okay, I love her back.
But I'm going to go after something that has been a long-standing dispute. It's not really low-hanging fruit in that context. And today I'm going to talk about the death penalty. And what really brought it to mind to me was just last Sunday, a gentleman by the name of Joseph Duncan died of brain cancer. That not in and of itself would not really be news, except for Joseph Duncan was a convicted serial killer. He had killed a number of children. And he had been sentenced to death back in 2011. To me, he becomes a real example, among others that have occurred very recently, of why the death penalty doesn't work. And that is simply that you have to take a look at the death penalty in its entirety, starting from the time someone gets arrested, to see that just the fact that the death penalty exists changes a lot of things. The Supreme Court has on occasions, and other people will argue to you and say that every trial is the same. It doesn't matter if it's a misdemeanor, a traffic ticket, or a death case. And that's just not true. Death is different. And so the Supreme Court, much to his hypocrisy at times, defines that certain things shouldn't happen simply because of the severity of the penalty. So they clearly take this into consideration. The trials of a death case are different because of things like the number of jurors. For example, in the state of Florida, if it's not a capital offense, you only get 6 jurors, you don't get 12. Jurors decide the penalty. That doesn't happen in many cases in many states or in other places. The lawyering is different in that we make a point of giving defendants, more than one lawyer. And we make sure that they're specially certified or capable of trying a death case. The penalty itself is irreversible once it's imposed. It presumes the perfectness of our system. And it just is at this point, it's different all around. Judges treat it differently. Lawyers treat it differently. The press treats it differently. Everything becomes different. And then we move on to once someone is sentenced to death, it gets treated even more differently. And that is that we have a situation where people sit on death row for inordinate periods of time. For example, we have more than 2,500 people in death row in this country, 332 in Florida alone, although we used to have almost 600 until there were some rulings done by a couple of courts that forced the courts to change the sentences to life without parole. The only place that people don't actually sit around for a long time is Texas. While other states are doing away with the death penalty, they installed an express lane for people who have three eyewitnesses to the homicide. They move right to the front of the line. It costs the state of Florida $70,000 per inmate more per year to house someone on death row than it costs to put someone in the general population. And when we had 600 people, we were talking, what was that?
I have to interject. What was that? So it's the prison system that's making the money, isn't it? The state is paying.
No, it's not the prison. No, it's the people of the state of Florida. It's the people of the state of Florida that are paying this, $42 million a year at one point, more to house prisoners who are on death row, because they're not allowed to be in the general population. They're restricted to their to their cells 23 hours a day. The average length of time in the state of Florida is 22 years, 15 years between conviction and execution. There are 22 people on death row who have been there since the 1980s. We have nine that have been there since the 1970s. The stays range from 20 now to 40 years before their execution. There is no evidence that the death penalty deters any crime. Nobody sits there and thinks, "Wait a minute, I don't want to pull the trigger because I don't want to go to I don't want to be executed." They don't think that way.
Right.
And the death penalty doesn't work in any theory of punishment. It doesn't. It's not utilitarian because it doesn't deter the general public. It isn't retributive because too many people die before they are actually executed or sit there for years beyond the time that those people who need closure get closure. And in many ways, putting someone to death or putting them on death row is more humane than it is to put them in the general population for the rest of their lives. For whatever the reasons may be, and I follow the thought processes of the very late Jerry Kogan, who was, just an idol. I just idolize this guy. He served on the Florida Supreme Court. He was a one-man dissent against six conservatives in his term as the Chief Justice, and went around the state saying death penalty doesn't work, death penalty doesn't work. The death penalty doesn't work. It's just too expensive. It doesn't provide what people want from the death penalty, and as a result of which, I see no purpose for its continuance in our justice system. That's
what I
think about that. Then
why is it? Why does it continue then?
I think there are just people who believe in an eye for an eye, that somehow that gives them some sort of their own personal retribution and their own vengeance, but it doesn't serve the purpose of society under any circumstances. It just doesn't. And there's some very bad people who people would say they deserve to die. Why should we support them in prison? Well, you know, if you really want them to be punished, put them in GPOP for 40 years. Well, you know, that's more to me. If it was me and I got sentenced and I got a choice, I'd jump off the third tier the first chance I got. I wouldn't want to spend 40 years in prison. So I don't know why we continue it other than it's another one of those third rails that most politicians don't want to touch.
Hmm.
Other than that, I can't think of a reason for its existence. And in the state of Florida, every single death penalty case goes directly to the Supreme Court. It doesn't go to an intermediary appellate court. So they spend anywhere from, at one point, they spend as much as 90% of their time on death penalty cases and could not litigate the cases that really needed to be litigated.
Wow.
So I just don't see its purpose. And I don't know why we continue to do it other than it just makes some people feel better, I guess.
Hmm.
Some people, not everybody. And I'll leave it at that.
Is it the prison system that's pushing to keep this going? Are they the ones that are getting wealthy?
No. In fact, the prison system doesn't want to spend the money on them. If you ask the Department of Corrections what they could do with $42 million that's not being spent on death row inmates, they could find a use for that money.
I'm sure.
$42 million a year. So I don't see why. No, the death. I think it's just a political issue that no one wants to touch.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the way that I can't think of any other reason for it. And we're the only real true Western democracy that still executes people.
Mm-hmm.
That must tell you something, too. So
why do we keep it?
So,
do we know? Just for those few people who need some sort of closure?
No, it's for the loudest people who speak.
And who are they?
It's for the people who have a vested interest in their minds in seeing someone executed.
I see.
And the only people that really offend me more than anyone else are the people, the right-to-lifers, the people who are anti-abortionists, who believe in the death penalty. I thought a life was a life. And
it
I'll
is.
Just leave that statement for what it is. A life is a life. So if you believe in life, you believe in life for everybody, I guess. I don't know.
No, you
so
do.
I'll leave
You're
it
right.
Yeah. Including cellular life. Right? That's...
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
You got people say human cells. So what if you execute somebody? Yeah, you've got the guilty brain, but you've got all those other human cells too. And a lot of that stuff doesn't make any sense. But the constitutional hook to what Jeff's talking about, and I'll use this to launch into my own what I really think here, which of course I've changed in the last 15 minutes, what I was going to say.
I was going to be surprised. Okay.
Yeah, that every week's the same thing. I come in thinking, here's what I'm going to talk about. And then I listen and we chat and I decide, let's talk about something else.
You're brilliant off the cuff. So, I mean, I don't know how, I don't even know how you do it.
hard
you're
but
90 miles an hour. That's very good.
No, you both did a perfect setup for this. So, the constitutional hook is the Eighth Amendment. The question always is the death penalty a cruel and unusual punishment? And, that brings us, Hezzy, to your opening point, which was the Constitution and how it's interpreted and how it changes and it's a living document. As you were talking about that, it came to mind, and I kind of want to throw this out there, see what both of you think about it. There's a huge debate among judges and scholars and lawyers about how to interpret the Constitution, obviously. And one of the reasons that's so difficult, I always tell students this, if you arrived in law school, and having ever said in a debate with somebody, just apply the Constitution as it's written, fine, okay, so, you got that out of your system. But promise me that you'll never say that again, because that is such a cop-out. The Constitution absolutely cries out for interpretation, including terms like cruel and unusual punishment, right? Cruel and unusual punishment. There are even broader terms in the Constitution like the word liberty, right? What does the word liberty mean? Liberty is promised to us in three different places in the Constitution. So there's also a term called due process, right, that most people have heard. Process that's due. What does that mean? These are very general, vague terms. And the Constitution was written that way for a reason. If you think about writing any document that's supposed to last for a long time, say you're a company that uses vehicles for delivery, and you want to enter into a 99-year contract with an automobile manufacturer. And I ask students this too: if you're writing that contract as a lawyer, would you write Company X promises to lease all of its Ford F-150s from such and such dealer for the next 99 years? And of course, students say, no, that would be ridiculous. In 99 years, we probably won't have Ford F-150s. Right. So instead of Ford F-150, you write something like vehicle, right? You use more general terms. And so the Constitution is written that way. So the debate comes down to this. How do you understand the word liberty? Does the word liberty in the Constitution, does that promise mean that I can marry whoever I want, right? Does the word liberty mean, without the government's interference, without the government dictating, does the word liberty mean that if I'm a parent, I get to raise my kids instead of the government raising my kids? Does the word liberty mean that I get to decide the composition of my family, right, without the government's interference? Does the word liberty mean that my own sexual life, including contraceptives and things like that, is my business and not the government's? These are the questions. Is that what liberty means? Well, there's one school of thought called originalism. To the question that you posed at the beginning and Jeff's comments about it, originalism, by the way, has taken hold, as Jeff can talk about too. Here's the idea. According to originalists, and Justice Scalia was the leader of this, but now it's just taken root, the Constitution means what it meant, right? Whatever it would have meant to somebody who was reading it at the time that it was adopted. So liberty means, to an originalist, right, liberty means, let's say you're talking about the Liberty Clause and the Fifth Amendment. The Fifth Amendment, the effective date is 1791. Therefore, to an originalist, liberty means whatever it would have meant in 1791. As you can imagine, that's a pretty restrictive view, right, of what liberty means. Then on the other side, we have what we call living constitutionalists, who believe that the date of the adoption of a constitutional provision is the starting point, but that you also consider events that have unfolded over time in evolving standards and values and norms and contemporary life, right? That's a living originalist. A living constitutionalist would say, that's how we should interpret the words. Basically, interpret them to mean what they mean now, right, in light of history. Here's my criticism of originalism. Under this view, and this is something I'm kind of writing about, under this view, the key point is time, right? It's not the semantics or the depth of meaning. It's time. So an originalist would tell you, maybe under contemporary standards in 2021, maybe now liberty means, same-sex marriage, right, or reproductive rights of some kind. But that's not what it meant in 1791. Right? It's not what it meant in 1868. By this thinking, we can change the meaning of the Constitution by adopting exactly the same language now that's already in there. Because originalists pin their philosophy or their jurisprudence on time, if we were to readopt the word liberty in 2021, just add a new amendment to the Constitution that guarantees liberty, like the Constitution already does, then an originalist would have to concede that liberty, that the word liberty now means what it would mean in 2021. So we could, by originalist thinking, right, amend the meaning of the Constitution without changing any of its words, simply by amending it now, because that would change the time of the adoption of the provision dictates how that provision is interpreted. And so my criticism boils down to this. if you're operating under a philosophy where you could alter the meaning of the Constitution without changing its words, that sounds like a pretty silly philosophy, right? And certainly flies in the face that, you know, if you were to go back and ask the drafters of the Constitution, why did you use this vague language, they would have told you so that you wouldn't have to do a ridiculous thing like that. You don't have to keep readopting the same language to drag the Constitution into contemporary times. The reason we use this kind of language was so that it can yield different results in different times. So that was something I wanted to throw out there because of the earlier conversation we had. But to your point, I think that your opening question, in my mind, is one of the most interesting constitutional questions there is. Which is, again, how do we interpret the Constitution? Is it static? Is it rigid? Or is it malleable and ductile? So that's a big debate and one that people should be aware of.
You know,
I got one more question.
I wanted to follow up on what Brendan said. It might lead into your question, Hezzy.
Okay.
There are a few things that I wanted to point out. There are words that we use when we talk about the Constitution and what it means to certain people. When we talk about equality, you will not find such a word in the Constitution. We talk about privacy, you will not find such a word in the Constitution. Another example is we talk about ineffective or the need for effective assistance of counsel. That doesn't exist in the Constitution. Those are all words that were used to interpret or to give meaning to what is in the Constitution. The Constitution spoke of men. It never speaks of women. And yet we have interpreted the Constitution so that it includes those people meaning women, after we gave women the right to vote. So that somehow we decided that we now need to start bringing things in to show that one amendment, okay, the 19th Amendment, meant more than what the 19th Amendment says. And the last thing is that the way that I look at it is that the purpose of being able to have the courts interpret the Constitution as it relates to the way that we live today versus the way they lived in 1788 is simply because it's meant to avoid a continuing amendment process over every single issue that would come before us in our lives every single year. We'd have Congress and the states trying to ratify amendments to deal with a particular issue. And so now we allow the Constitution to be used to effectuate those amendments and those changes that need to affect our lives today and how we live today. I mean, the Constitution in California has, 60 or 70 amendments to it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's absurd. Okay, but in Florida, we do the same thing. We pass amendments to deal with a particular issue about, for example, how we raise pigs that are going to be slaughtered. Okay, I'm not lying about this. There actually is a thing in there about that. Okay, so it really comes down to the point that, as I said at the beginning, I think it's a guideline, and we operate from those guidelines, and we adopt our laws to comport with those guidelines as need be in the lives that we are living today or at any time in the future.
Very, very exciting. Does anyone know, other than me, because I don't know, is our Constitution the only one that gives such a broad capacity to expand the definition that it makes, such as how it defines liberty and how it defines, you know, people's rights and stuff like that? Was the English the same way? Because I didn't study the English Constitution, so I don't know if they gave the same latitude to its people that we do here in the United States?
I think the easiest way to answer that is the only constitution that the British have is the Magna Carta.
Yeah.
And what's grown out of it. And so it's had to change and be interpreted over, what, 900 years?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they call themselves a constitutional monarchy, but the Constitution or what they operate on and the laws that they pass are all based upon a document that's 900 years old.
Yeah, that's true.
I think I'm right about that, aren't I?
Brandon, yeah, and in a sense, what that means is there really is no constitution in the UK. It's unlike the United States, where the constitution is obviously the supreme law. In many countries, whatever the legislature says is the supreme law, or what, you know, whoever has the legislative power, whether that's whether that power rests with one person or with a body of persons. Right, whatever, that's the supreme law of the land. The United States is you know, I wouldn't say unique, but it's unusual in its fealty to our founding document. And so that's you know, one of the markers of U.S. law. You know, and I did want to point out, too, I mean, some of the Constitution is not vague at all. I mean, you have to be at least 35 to be president. All right, well, we can all figure that out, right? That's pretty specific. You know, the Electoral College rules, you know, that were, you know, almost blew up on January 6th. You know, that's pretty specific stuff. But, yeah, the concepts like cruel and unusual punishment, due process, liberty, those are very vague terms and cry out for interpretation. And that actually could segue into something I wanted to, I talked to Jeff earlier about this and wanted to ask him. Just speaking of constitutional terms and interpreting them, search and seizure, we just had a Supreme Court case on that come down. And Jeff teaches that stuff, the Fourth Amendment stuff, and his criminal procedure course. So I wanted to get his thoughts on the Supreme Court's, and since we're talking about constitutional interpretation, the Supreme Court's recent interpretation of what seizure means.
Yeah,
it's an interesting case. It's called Torres versus Madrid. It was actually a civil case where Ms. Torres was suing the police department, and Madrid was the officer that was involved in all of this. This happened in New Mexico 7 years ago. They fired 13 shots at Ms. Torres as she tried to drive away from them. She was, as it was shown, she was driving under the influence. She was under the effect of methamphetamine, and they tried to stop her. And when she attempted to drive away, they fired 13 shots at her. Two of them struck her in the back. But she managed to drive to a hospital. And she went to sue the police department, who claimed that based on her case called the Hodari case, that she had never been seized. And so therefore, her Fourth Amendment rights were not violated, therefore she had no cause of action. And the Hodari case was written by Justice Scalia, who said the term seizure is defined as you would find it in the dictionary, which is very unique because we don't usually look at a dictionary to define our terms, at least not in the law. And it basically is when you lay hands on someone and you actually have hold of them, you are seized. And the import of that case for Justice Scalia was that Mr. Hodari had seen some police coming. He started to run away. While he was running away, he dropped some drugs on the ground. And then the police officer's yelling, "Stop, police," and he doesn't stop. And he grabs on to finally reaches Mr. Hodari, grabs him, and then goes back and picks up the drugs and charges him with possession. And Hodari claimed, wait a minute, you had no reason to be chasing me. You had no cause to chase me. And so as a result of which, when I dropped the drugs, I was seized because you were chasing me. And the court said, no, you're seized when he got hands on you. So when you dropped the drugs, you weren't seized. Therefore, the drugs were not dropped or found as a result of an unlawful seizure. We can charge you with that offense. In Torres, mm-hmm. the court does this gyration of saying, at least initially, the lower court said that she wasn't seized because they never put hands on her. The court in Torres versus Madrid said, no, hold on. If I fire a gun at you and the bullet strikes you, I have touched you, and therefore you have been seized. But if you run away and I fire a gun at you and I miss, you aren't seized.
Oh.
So just being struck by a bullet made a seizure. Well, if that's the case, the interpretation now stands on its head from Hodari. So they kind of reversed it and actually found for Ms. Torres and said she's got a cause of action. She was seized. So now is it going to be, are we getting to the point where when a police officer tells you to stop, you are seized? I don't think they're going to go there. They don't want to go that far. But if they shoot you, you're seized. Even if you run away and you get away, you've been seized. That's how they interpreted in order to give Ms. Torres a cause of action. It was actually a 5-3 decision. Justice Comey Barrett didn't participate because she wasn't there for the oral arguments. So it's an interesting way that the court kind of gyrates itself to reach a decision that they want. This is one of the things that we've avoided for over 200 years, is making the Supreme Court a court of equity to the extent that it makes individual decisions on every case independently on a case-by-case basis. We set precedent, we set rules, we set doctrine, and people are supposed to follow that doctrine, which is why they usually reach out to really outrageous cases in order to set that doctrine. They do that over and over again. They look for the best case to make that decision. So it's an interesting decision. It seems to overturn the Hodari thought process or reach some thought process that when you fire the bullet, your hand goes with the bullet wherever it goes. I'm not sure that I see that as a proper thought process, but that's where they went with this. So it's an interesting decision. It's a perfect example that they would do this. I mean, the holding infuriated Neil Gorsuch. It was a very irritable dissent, and he just accused Justice Roberts and the majority of distorting history to locate a desired result. He may not have been wrong.
Mm-hmm.
He may not have been wrong in this instance. They wanted to get to a result that would give this defendant a cause of action, I guess, as a deterrent against police use of shootings to try to give them some sort of deterrence. But that desired result may kind of overturned a thought process and made everything kind of equitable, and I'm not sure that that was the proper decision. As much as I'd like to see causes of action, some of this immunity that police officers and police departments get, this qualified immunity, somewhat diminished, I don't think this was the right case to do it with.
Mm-hmm.
Gorsuch was a really unhappy guy. His dissent is you should read it. It's something to behold.
It's interesting. So what did what would Gorsuch say was a seizure? Just he did repeat the Hodari standard?
Yeah, he would go with the Hodari situation, that she was never seized.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that was his thought process, that we go with what Hodari said. When you get hands on him, you get hands on him. Or the alternative is, if the police say, hey, you come over here, and you are seized because you're consenting or assenting to the authority of the police officer,
mm-hmm.
Which we saw in another case called Streif about 4 years ago. So that's basically the thought process. You know, if I'm a police officer and I yell, hey, you come over here and you do, according to the court, you are seized.
Right.
You've acceded to the authority of the police officer, and that does it. But and he felt that that was a proper ruling, and it should not have been basically overturned in this case.
That's interesting. You talk about and Hodari, Justice Scalia, relying on the dictionary. And as you mentioned, that's not usually where we get our legal interpretation. It's a rather kind of a formalistic approach to interpreting words, not just of the Constitution, but of statutes and ordinances as well. But it's really interesting you brought that up. One of our colleagues, a professor emeritus here and one of the best-known legal writing gurus in the country named Joe Kimball, who I'm honored to call a friend and mentor, he has written quite extensively about the use of dictionaries, and it's amazing the original research he's done. Using dictionaries is really a hazardous to your legal health.
Oh, yeah. it is.
Yeah, you know. First of all, it depends what dictionary you use, right? I mean, you know, dictionaries have widely varying definitions of words. Even the same dictionary, of course, will have four different shades, right, of definition of the same word, and you can just pick the one you want. And the hazard here is that, you know, judges who throw dictionaries around, they you know, they're sort of covering themselves with this cloak of objectivity, right? Oh, you know, all I did was cite the dictionary definition. No, what you did was cite a dictionary definition, which invariably is going to be the one you like the most, right?
Exactly.
So
Merriam-Webster was not a lawyer, by the way.
Right. 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 And, I mean, so that's interesting. So, Jeff, I wanted to ask you, so it sounded like you're not a fan of Scalia's approach there, but did he have the right, despite the fact that he was using dictionaries when maybe he shouldn't have, did he come down with what you think is the correct definition of seizure?
Well, yeah, I think that as long as I think he was right on the Hodari case in the context that Mr. Hodari was not acceding to the authority of the police officer. He really did not want to stop, and as a result of which was running away, and putting hands on him was actually a seizure. I think the thought process, and here's where you could carry this. If running away from an officer who says stop, okay, is a seizure, okay, and then does that mean the person who runs away is escaping custody? And is a seizure the same thing as custody?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so, you know, I think he got it right in the Hodari case. I think he was as much as it reached a result, which resulted in drugs that the guy dropped on the ground, that Hodari dropped on the ground being used against him and not being suppressed, I think he got it right. Whether I would have gone to the dictionary, I'm not sure, but I think that he got it right. We don't always get it right when you use a dictionary interpretation. For example, custody to most people is the same thing as a seizure. You know, a police officer has custody, mm-hmm. He's holding on to you, okay? Yet when you read the Miranda decision, that's not necessarily custody for purposes of receiving your Miranda rights. Okay, custody, you can be sitting in a room with a police officer who does not have his hands on you, can voluntarily show up. But it may be that the circumstances are such that you don't feel that you are free to leave. That's the definition mm-hmm. of custody for Miranda purposes, that a reasonable person would not believe they are free to leave. What does that have to do with putting handcuffs on people? Or putting him in jail? A person who is in prison may not be in custody for Miranda purposes because he is free to leave the interview. He is free not to talk to the police officer. He's free to go back to his cell if he wants to. Okay? He's not literally in the custody of the police officer. He's in custody. He's in jail. but he's not in custody for Miranda purposes. So words mean different things and interpreted for different purposes in the law than you would see in a dictionary. And how we apply those words is how we define them. But in the case of Hodari, I think the simplistic approach of the dictionary actually worked for Scalia. I don't think he was wrong.
Right.
You know, and that's hard for me to say. I'm going to have to take a Clorox shower later having said that. Okay.
With all due humility, when are you going to become the next Supreme Court justice?
Never. Brendan will get there, but
I
won't.
So brilliant.
No, I won't get there. I'm too old, but Brendan's still young enough. Okay.
Oh, I see. Brendan
will get there.
I had no idea.
Not well connected enough, I can tell you that.
Well, I could put it that way.
You know,
way.
Jeff Swartz.
I mean, I can give that excuse. It's not that I'm not important enough. I'm too old. How's that? Okay.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that's my trouble. That's my trouble. I'm too old.
You know, at almost 72 years old, they don't appoint 72-year-olds to the bench. So, you know, my time has passed. Okay. Hand it off to the next generation.
I'm following your footsteps. I'm 71.
Good
half,
for
practically.
You. Practically, yeah. I'm not a year old. I'm a year and a half. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. What else do you want to talk about today?
I feel 75. Does that count?
Yes, it does.
No. No, it doesn't. Okay. Just makes me feel younger because I don't feel like I'm 72.
Find out what it means then.
Oh God!
Well, let's talk about stuff that's going on today. We can talk about the Chauvin case.
Yeah.
I think we need to talk about it.
Okay, then.
What about what?
Will there be time? I understand that Biden wants to put more people on the court. Did I read that right?
Well. I'm not sure about that. I hadn't heard that. I think that he's prepared to do just about anything to get his agenda in place, not on a political basis, but what he thinks is right for the country.
Okay.
So I'm not sure he's ready to go that far yet.
Right.
There haven't been any real decisions that have caused him to reach that conclusion. I think if they push that button on Roe v. Wade, that could cause that to happen. But he hasn't. It's going to be hard for him to do that without 60 votes in the Senate. I don't think he's going to get – he's going to have to throw out the filibuster completely to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, by the way, if I'm John Roberts right now, my number one priority as an institutionalist is to preserve the institution as it exists right now. Mm-hmm. And – that means he has got to be having talks with Amy Coney Barrett and Kavanaugh and Gorsuch and the rest. Whether they're inclined to, as Jeff just mentioned, overrule Roe versus Wade or not, they'd better find a way to deal with these hot button issues that does not provoke the Democratic majority right now. And Roberts is smart enough to know that. If they were to come out and overrule Roe versus Wade, you'd have the votes in the Senate to add more seats to the court the next day. But that's why I don't think they'll do it. I think that they will chip away at things like the abortion right without outright overruling it so that they don't provoke this president. And I also agree with Jeff that I don't think Biden is there right now. I think Biden is way too focused. No, I don't mean too focused. He shouldn't be focused. I mean, he's so focused on COVID and the economy, and I think that's very smart not to lose his focus on that. He doesn't want to fight like that unless he needs it.
Okay.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. I think that it just he's just this is not a time. to fight that battle. The one thing you got to give Biden credit for is that he's picking his battles and he's fighting them as they come along. And I think he's prepared to fight over certain things, and they're part of his agenda that he thinks is necessary for the country, all really, to me, relating to COVID and the economy. And I think he believes that those are the most important things. He is now confronted with the Voting Rights Act problem, thanks to the state of Georgia and Arizona. It's probably going to be next. And so he... he's got a battle now that he really didn't want, a battle that he hoped he wouldn't have to fight, and now he's going to have to fight it. And he knows he has to fight it both for political reasons and for the good of the country. There's an underlying political interest in what he has to do, and we cannot deny that that exists. But I think that he understands that. I think there's a greater good that he has to fight this for. I'm sorry, I do not want to live in the 1880s and 1890s and 1920s of the history of this country. I'm sorry, I just don't want to go back to that. And the thought process of six old white guys sitting around a desk or standing around a desk with a picture of a plantation painting on the wall behind them, signing a law that stops black people from voting, okay, while a black legislator is being arrested for knocking on a door because the officer thinks he's facing an insurrection, okay, and that's his excuse. He thought he saw January 6th happening in the state capital of Georgia when there were 30 people there filming this woman knocking on a door, okay. I don't want to live in that world. I don't think that we need to live in that type of country. And I'm sorry, this is just a perfect example of old white guys being afraid of losing their power and being afraid that they're just not going to be in charge anymore.
That's I never all thought it of it that way from those years, that they were also struggling with that same issue that we struggle with today. Never
yes.
thought of that. That's brilliant.
It's just old white guys afraid of losing their power.
Mm-hmm.
We're in charge. God created us to be in charge. And you're not going to take it away from us, and we're not going to be controlled by people who are not white.
Mm-hmm.
And so they will do anything they can to suppress other people from taking their power away. And they're nothing more than despots. Okay,
yeah.
They're not individuals as despots. They, as a group, are nothing more than despots. And it may be, as I've said before, we may not see the end of this until that whole generation is dead, gone, buried, and forgotten. We may not see the end because there are some people who will fight to the death over this. The South shall rise again. The Confederacy wasn't wrong. That's their thought process. It's got to end. It's got to end.
And one of the great abominations in modern Supreme Court lore is a case called Shelby County. Which was a relatively recent case where the Supreme Court struck down a key provision of the Voting Rights Act, an opinion that, let's just say, did not age well. Basically, in that court, in that case, the court per Justice Roberts said that times have changed. The South is a much different place than it used to be. You know, we used to have a racism problem in this country, but it's just not such an issue anymore. So it's really not necessary, in our opinion, right, says the court, even though the Constitution expressly authorizes Congress to make laws about voting rights for minorities. The court says, you know, in our opinion, this is no longer an appropriate way for Congress to do its business. And here we are. Right. Here we are. No sooner does the Supreme Court say things have changed in the South than Georgia goes ahead, right, and enacts this unbelievable new restrictive law that, as President Biden likes to point out, because it's sort of the most graphic illustration of how silly, how ridiculous, how and really how evil this is. It makes it a crime for you to give food or water to somebody who's waiting in line to vote. So what we do mm-hmm. is we make sure you have to wait in line for 7 hours to vote, and then we make it illegal for anybody to give you water while you wait.
And the purpose of that, and that purpose of that section has never been spoken of. But the purpose is that it's meant to make people who are standing in line to vote give up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's what it's meant to do. It's meant to make it so onerous that if they don't bring their own water and they don't bring their own food and they don't bring their own chair and they break the line, they go back to the end of the line.
Uh-huh.
And it's meant to make them give up. I mean, can you imagine standing in line for 7 or 8 hours and you're not even allowed to leave the line to go to the bathroom?
Right.
Okay, this is incredibly, it was just meant to break the lines. And, of course, they create their polling places so that the lines exist in African-American communities.
Right.
You don't see long lines in white areas. You only see it in African-American areas. And the whole idea that just, you know, the 1960, the old Voting Rights Act is no longer applicable to us, so now we can go do what we want to do. And it's just in time to probably put a real kibosh on any challenges to the way that redistricting is done to assure Republicans have control over state houses or maybe take back the House. And I can see this court saying, no, we don't involve ourselves in that. That's a state's rights issue.
Right. Yep.
And I can see that coming, which is why we come back to the one bill that may bust the filibuster, and that's H.R. 1. Because these issues are specifically spoken of, that, for example, in H.R. 1, it is necessary for the states to form nonpartisan, independent commissions to do the redistricting, to make sure that there's no gerrymandering going on. People like Jim Jordan would be out of Congress. Jim Jordan has one of the great gerrymandered districts in the history of the country. It rivals the district in South Florida that ran from the tip of the peninsula, okay, 10 miles wide up the state of Florida to Palm Beach County. Okay, I mean, think about it. Dante Fasal and Lane Bloom held those seats. I mean, seriously, a Democrat, if you won the nomination, you didn't have to campaign. It was a shoe-in. And a lot of times they ran unopposed. So it's one of those things where H.R. 1 is important to deal with just what Brendan was talking about. And the court is going to have to turn on its heels and reverse itself. Because if I'm sitting there and I voted for that, and now I'm seeing what George is doing, if I'm Roberts, I'm sitting here saying, you just made a liar out of me.
Right.
I don't like you anymore. You made a liar out of everybody in the majority. Every one of us is now a liar.
Right.
Either that or we are considered so naive that we are incapable of ruling appropriately.
Right. Yep.
You know, this is what happens when you only have, you know, 8 friends, or in Gorsuch's case, Kavanaugh's case, only one. So, I mean, you know, just, okay. Okay. So, I mean, that's just what happens. So, yeah, it's a horrible, terrible thing that's going on.
Yeah.
And they've got to get put in their place.
Yeah. It's going to be an interesting opportunity for federal courts to do that. Just to kind of throw this out there, for anybody who's interested in the arguments that we're going to see here, there are basically, you know, when you have voting restrictions and they're challenged, and obviously there are going to be lawsuits left and right over this, what the challengers want courts to do is apply something called strict scrutiny, which, as the name suggests, is rather fatal to the government, right? Because when a court strictly scrutinizes a law, it's looking for whether the means chosen are narrowly tailored, right? The perfect way to achieve some really compelling interest. To get a court to apply that level of scrutiny, the challengers here have to show one of two things. Either that the law substantially interferes with the right to vote. And of course, what George is going to say is, we've changed the rules, but we're not substantially interfering with the right to vote because you can still vote. Or we're not stopping anybody from voting. But if a court concludes that there is substantial interference, which is just a fact question, then we get the strict scrutiny and Georgia would be in a lot of trouble. The other way to get there, and this is going to be a very interesting argument, the other way to get there is to claim ethnicity-based discrimination, that even though the law on its face is neutral, right, it doesn't say anything about race or ethnicity, as applied, as courts put it, it has a disproportionate impact on African-American communities, and that impact is purposeful, right? That was the purpose of it. So we're going to have a big fight of that, too. Ethnicity-based discrimination, again, if you can show purposeful discrimination, triggers strict scrutiny as well. Both of those arguments are going to arise under the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Clause. Courts have used that clause to insist on what they call, you know, the principle of one person, one vote. And so, you know, to Jeff's point, if federal judges, including the Supreme Court, have had enough of this, and that have, you know, having been made fools of since writing the Shelby County case, they will have their opportunity to strike down Georgia's law. So we'll have to keep an eye on that. Yeah.
Yeah, they'll have their opportunity to do just that. I'm looking at what's happening there, and I can only sit there and say to myself, it doesn't take a genius. They wrote some good stuff into the bill to try to ameliorate bad stuff, but the bad stuff is so bad. I think the number one exhibit that I would put up if I were trying the case against this statute is I would hold up a demonstrative piece of evidence, a frame with two pictures on it, the people signing the Declaration of Independence and or the Constitution, and the picture of those six white guys with the plantation behind them signing a bill trying to take rights away from people. And I say, which do you believe in? Do you believe in the Constitution, or do you believe in these six white guys? And the guys on the left are all white, too. So which group of white guys do you believe in? I mean, that's my opening statement, Judge. I'll put on my evidence now.
Right.
I don't know what more you can do. Okay, that's my opening statement, Judge. Here it is. I'll leave it up here for you to look at on this easel during the trial, okay?
That was an amazing visual. It really was. And I remember seeing, I didn't have to have anybody explain to me that was a painting of a plantation behind them. You can tell. Right. I mean, they all, you know, they're all built in a similar structure. Right. I mean, that visual, six white guys in front of a painting of a plantation, which, of course, the plantation that's in the painting has a history of, what, 100 or 200 slaves were held on that property. So, of course, Jeff, you know, I never did see.
By the way, the only thing that would have made it better, is that they were being served their drinks by a woman wearing an antebellum dress. Okay, that would have made it just a little bit better. Okay,
yeah,
go ahead. What
were
you going to ask, Brendan?
No, I was just going to say I've never seen Jeff try a case, but I would have loved to. You know, that's part of the law, right? Is making that emotional appeal, and that visual sure does the job. So,
and that brings us to the last thing we'll talk about, you can get on to your next guest, and that's the Chauvin case. And Brenda and I talked about what's going on in Minneapolis a little bit, And I let's put it this way. I have, and this is not a popular point of view, but I'm going to say it anyway. You know, at my age, I don't care if people get upset, I guess.
Your show.
My thought process, I've been watching what goes on over the last couple of days and even the few days leading into the start of the trial and during jury selection. I get offended at the thought process that people feel the need to lobby the public during a trial for a particular verdict. And defining justice as being a particular verdict. I understand that a person may have a desire for a particular verdict and think that's the right verdict. But is that how we define justice now? That you get the verdict you want, otherwise it's not justice? Justice, as I understand it, is a system. A system that is designed to bring about a decision. In an adversarial system, that's the way I define justice. And I really do get disturbed at this lobbying that goes on. And I give Ben Crump, for example, a great deal of credit. He is a good lawyer in the context of how he presents his clients. He's a good lawyer in how he represents them and the results he gets. He's a good lawyer in the way that he uses the press in a manner that is only rivaled, in my mind, by certain politicians, one of whom lives in the state of Florida now. He knows how to use the press, and he does it for the benefit of his clients. That's okay. But the idea that justice can only be served and confidence in our system can only be attained by a specific result in any one specific case belies your belief in the system at any time. Because all you're saying is, I believe the system can provide me with everything I want, and if they don't, then it's not justice. I have a problem with that. Okay? I'm not opining on whether Chauvin is guilty or not guilty of anything. I want the jury to make that decision. I want them to make it, and you've got a very diverse jury in this case, an incredibly diverse jury. And let them make the decision of what justice is in this case. That's their job. And the idea of lobbying in public and on the news and on every program that'll put your face on it for a specific verdict as being the only way justice is served, believing that somehow these thought processes or your words don't somehow reach these jurors, is just wrong. Of course they're going to reach the jurors. And it bothers me. I don't care what the case may be. I just don't see lobbying during a trial the public to obtain a verdict. Or saying that something is wrong or something will happen because you don't get the verdict you want. Let the system do what the system does. And if I agree that the system has not been fair at times. I accept that. But you change the system from within, not from without. And that's my main takeaway from Chauvin's case up until this day. I have thought processes on what occurred yesterday, but they're really not relevant to the conversation. So I got two what I thinks in today.
Yeah, you got two in. Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, hopefully some of this will stop. It won't. But hopefully some of this will stop. And we'll get down, and we are down to putting witnesses on the stand, putting on the evidence, proving a case or not proving a case, and a jury reaching an appropriate decision. That's what it's about.
Yep.
There you go.
Well, we've we've blown past 11 o'clock.
Sorry about that.
That's.
But that's okay. What a cliffhanger!
I'm sorry about that. At least you're thinking about what's going to come next.
Right.
Well, I just hope we don't fall off the cliff next week. You never know.
Right.
No. I'm wearing a parachute. I'll be just fine. Thanks.
Right.
All right.
Okay.
Well, gentlemen, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much, as usual.
Pleasure is mine. Yes. Thanks for having us.
Fantastic. I did forget to mention before in the opening that
you better say
the
it now.
Views expressed by Professor Beery and Forks are their own, and are not necessarily the view of the administration of WMU Cooley Law School or its faculty as a whole. So I hope you understand all that.
Right.
I think our listeners do.
That's it. Good. Hang me out to dry now.
No, this is really great. This is perfect. Mm-hmm. Why do we even have that clause? People getting sued over their opinion?
Yeah, you asked that, and then they don't want what I say to reflect upon the school itself. I mean, they're obviously concerned about the students being stuck with what I say, or the administration having to defend what I say. The idea is that that's just me, and that's just Brendan. That's all.
Well, don't normal people think of it that way? Do they think that they speak for the administration or the university? Isn't that supposed to be? Well, wouldn't you need to say that? I'm speaking for the WMU Cooley.
If they don't admit, if you're identified as being a professor there, and they don't disclaim the things that you say, okay, that's a problem.
I see.
Especially if you say something that is actionable. So that's why.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
So how do you live your life? Your life is so structured then.
I don't get structured. Do you, Brendan?
No. No, you know. Yeah, just as long as you disclaim.
Restriction.
No.
Okay.
There's a lot of freedom to say what you think, as long as you just make sure you're speaking for yourself. So,
right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And in fairness, that's not just our law school. Any law school. You know, if you see people tweeting and they're a law professor somewhere, you know, their Twitter homepage is going to say opinions are my own, right? Just to make sure there's no confusion. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, a pleasure as always. This is getting too good. This is going to be the preeminent show. I don't know what we're going to
do. Well, all we need is another 5 or 6 listeners, and we'll be all set.
yes, it would. I think people are really interested in the Constitution.
Yeah, I hope
I mean,
so.
They don't have to come to a formal class in order. It's very exciting to me, at least. Maybe I'm the aberration. I don't know. I just find it interesting. It's a learning experience.
I don't know. I don't think you're wrong, Hezzy, because I teach a class for the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute from University of South Florida. And I teach it every other term. And it's about the Constitution and mostly about what SCOTUS is doing and what they have done and what they're going to do. And the minute that the catalog comes out and the course is there, I've been told within an hour the course is filled.
Mm-hmm.
And at times I've been asked to expand the course to allow more people in. So I think there are people who are truly interested. And if nothing came out of the Trump administration, there's a renewed interest in what the Constitution says or doesn't say.
Right.
Right.
Or whether the Constitution survives.
Right.
Good question, too.
So, I mean,
well, gentlemen,
there's a big interest in that, though.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. It seems like it's just a difficult issue, but it's really simpler than I think people may have imagined. Mm-hmm. And it's so exciting.
More understandable, at least.
Just comes to life.
It's more understandable. Yeah.
Yeah, you bring it to the point of understandability. Well, gentlemen, have a great week. I can't wait till next week.
You too.
This is getting too good to be true.
Maybe it's really not. Okay.
Yeah, right.
Well, you never know. We may get 7 or 8 people next week.
Sounds good.
All right. Okay, take care of yourself, Ezzy. And by the way, good Pesach to you.
And you too. All the best.
Very well.
Easter as well. So take care.
Yes.
Thank you, gentlemen. What a
pleasure.
Thank
you.
All right.
Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
How exciting. Learning about the Constitution. I just love it. I think it's just so terrific. Well, let's move on to our next guest. Let me see. No, I think this is not our first. These are probably some of our first guests. So what we're going to do is, it seems that our second guest today has not been able to make it, which is not a problem. So, you know, I can go on for 2 hours easily. So I never worry about it. Yeah, I guess that's loquacious. That's the definition. So I just keep going. It's really pathetic, but that's the way it is. Okay. So we just wish Glenn Lane of Westchester Family Care, he coordinates at-home care for seniors who are aging in place in Westchester County and Connecticut. So the catalyst for the conversation today with Mr. Lane was the center over New York State allegedly hiding data concerning the number of deaths that occurred due to COVID-19 at the nursing home across the state. And so there were a lot of issues that are involved here. And I don't think this was all the fault of Governor Cuomo, but a lot of people want to blame him for it. But it's going to be very interesting. COVID-19 will have informed us how to take care of the aging population. And if we're going to use the same standards as we have in the past, or if there will be an adjustment, and what the adjustment will be and why it will be. So while I'm still lucid, you know, that's a good question. So at least I hope that, you know, since Professor Swartz is a year older than I, that I may have an opportunity just to hold out as long as he has. So that would be a gift in itself. All right. So let's move on before we speak to, we're going to speak to James Nolan at 11:30, and we're going to discuss something very interesting. He's trying to represent a district which is quite conservative. Part of it is the village of Bronxville, and part of it is a conservative section of Yonkers. And he is running as a Republican, which is very fascinating because so many people who were Republicans have moved over to the other side. I don't know if that sounds too good for them, but they have moved over. So they believe not so much necessarily in Democratic principles, but they believe that people will vote for them because they're Democrats. So you gotta love this local stuff. I mean, even we do this foolishness even on the national level and international level. But when it's done on the local level, you say like, oh, please give me a break. How many of you guys switching over today? And the gals are joining in as well. So that's the story about that. Well, I better get into something important. And bear with me a moment here. Because we'll do just very little international news. We've only got about 15 minutes before Mr. Nolan shows up. So let's see. Which this is very interesting because following a report, World Health Organization chief has called for deeper probe into the lab leak theory on COVID-19 origins. Well, he was not that open-minded a few months back. And to be honest with you, I found him to be constantly slugging it out and not being open-minded. I don't even know how he survives. Anyway, World Organization Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus on Tuesday, that's today, urged a deeper investigation into whether the coronavirus outbreak originated with a leak from a lab, as world leaders had pushed for a treaty to prepare for future pandemics. Well, a report by World Health Organization and Chinese experts obtained by Agence France Press ahead of the Tuesday publication had judged the lab leak hypothesis highly unlikely, saying the virus behind COVID-19 had probably jumped from bats to humans via an intermediary animal. But a potential leak, quote, requires further investigation, potentially with additional missions involving specialist experts, Tedros had said. He added that the international team had difficulty accessing raw data during the mission to China, demanding, quote, more timely and comprehensive data sharing, end quote, in the future. That's because he failed to get more data when he was originally requested to look into it. What, you know, these people are off the wall. Anyway, the report was released more than a year ago into the pandemic that has killed nearly 2.8 million people worldwide, with several countries battling new waves of infections. And on top of that, we hear that a lot of the drug companies says that they will need to re-inoculate people a year from now. So it's starting to look like the yearly flu shot, except it'll be the yearly COVID-19 shot or COVID shot. Anyway, together we must be better prepared to predict, prevent, detect, assess, and effectively respond to pandemics in a highly coordinated fashion, they all urged. Well, the call came in a joint article published in international newspapers today, penned by leaders from more than 20 countries, including Germany, France, South Korea, and South Africa, along with the European Union and the World Health Organization. I've lost all faith in the World Health Organization, as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, the time to act is now. The world cannot afford to wait until the pandemic is over to start planning for the next one, the World Health Body Chief told the virtual press conference. Well, thank God he's distancing. Anyway, the expert report on the origins of COVID-19 has had a troubled birth, with publication delays adding to the holdups and diplomatic wrangling that plagued the World Health Organization attempts to get experts into Wuhan, the city at the center of the initial outbreak. Well, they finally arrived on January 14, more than a year after the first cases surfaced. Experts believe the SARS-CoV-2 virus that causes the COVID-19 disease originally came from bats. Well, the report's author judged that the most likely scenario was that the virus had made a direct leap to humans while not ruling out other theories. Extremely knowledgeable, evidently, since he can't rule out other theories as well. Beijing's theory that the virus did not originate in China at all, but was imported in frozen food was judged possible, but very unlikely. Well, the Chinese are good at making up this stuff. Well, it's really the Communist Party that comes up with this stuff. Anyway, meanwhile, United Nations General Antonio Guterres from Brazilian, that's why it's Guterres, not Guterres, called for more debt relief for the poorest countries struggling with economic fallout from the pandemic. He urged a, quote, new debt mechanism allowing such options as debt swaps, buybacks, and cancellations to help worse-off countries. Addressing an online forum that included dozens of world leaders, he said the pandemic has pushed the world to, quote, the verge of a debt crisis, end quote, and required, quote, urgent action. My God, where has it been because this guy had been laying that he didn't know we required urgent action months and months ago. Anyway, we need to change the rules, he argued. Well, he didn't change the rules when he was around all this time. Anyway, more than a year into the pandemic, several countries are grappling with new waves of the virus, prompting a scramble to contain outbreaks with fresh antivirus measures. Italy said on Tuesday it would impose a 5-day quarantine on travelers arriving from EU countries, while Germany will beef up checks along land borders. People arriving have negative COVID tests. Local authorities in the German capital of Berlin and in Munich again suspended injections with the AstraZeneca jab for under 60s over new reports of rare blood clots among recipients, but called it a precautionary measure. They're so timid about everything. Anyway, in France, hospitals were under pressure after partial regional shutdowns failed to keep the numbers of people in intensive care below its second wave peak. And in Slovakia, Prime Minister Igor Matovič resigned over his handling of the pandemic. In Papua New Guinea, a sports center was converted into a makeshift hospital to cope with surging coronavirus infections in the impoverished nation. A shortage of nurses and doctors was further straining the system under stress. We've got nurses and doctors in tears at the moment, working back to back, night shift, day shift. Matt Cannon, chief executive of St. John Ambulance, Papua New Guinea, told Agence France-Presse. Well, the system's under strain, he added, putting them under immense strain. So those are some of the issues that you hear and you feel on the world stage, which is absolutely amazing. This is very interesting in Australia. Women are leading a cultural reckoning as claims of sexual abuse, sexism, besiege the Australian government. Well, cascading scandals of alleged rape, sexual misconduct, and discrimination inside Australia's parliament have destabilized the conservative government as accused ministers are sidelined and assault victims, women's groups, and female politicians demand a shakeup of what they describe as an endemic culture of, quote, toxic, end quote, masculinity within politics. Repeated reports of sexual misconduct, abuse, and harassment of women by Australia's political elite have triggered the biggest mass women's rallies in the country. The country has seen, and using the hashtag March for Justice hashtag, hundreds of thousands of women gathered all over the country in a second wave hashtag Me Too moment that galvanized women from the very young to the elderly and from all political stripes. At the march on the Capitol, the wives of former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull and Kevin Rudd stood hand in hand in a show of solidarity with Australian women despite their allegiances to opposing political parties. Australia's Sex Discrimination Commissioner Kate Jenkins said she'd never seen any moment like this. But by Monday, the fury unleashed at the March 15 demonstrations boiled over as Prime Minister Scott Morrison announced that two of his ministers caught in the eye of the storm of the Canberra allegations, Defence Minister Linda Reynolds and Attorney General Christian Porter, would lose their high portfolios but remain part of the cabinet. The Prime Minister's decision not to force them implicated ministers to resign has played into public perceptions of an entitled political class. Professor Catherine Lumby, a researcher and consultant on workplace cultures at Sydney University, says that like many countries, Australia has huge issues with sexual assault and harassment that have been ignored for decades, despite women consistently raising them. Unfortunately, there is a culture of masculinity in this country that can be toxic, Lumby had said. There's what's called a rape myth acceptance, end quote. What that is about is a man placing blame on women for their decision to sexually assault, thinking, well, she deserved it, she was drunk, or she was wearing provocative clothing. Reality is there's a deeply entrenched culture of misogyny among our so-called leaders, and it's born out of a culture of entitlement and privilege. Lumbee's assessment is reflected in the shocking and widespread allegations of abuse and mistreatment of women that have emerged from the highest political offices in the country. The allegations detail a range of abuses, from the use of the Parliament's chapel for sexual relations, signing sex workers into Parliament House, to a ministerial aide sacked after video footage emerged of him masturbating over the desk of a female minister's desk, and to the story of a woman who committed suicide after reporting to police a historical rape involving then Federal Attorney General Christian Porter. The woman had alleged the assault occurred when she was 16 years old in 1988, when both were still students. Porter has denied the allegations and launched defamation proceedings against Australia's public broadcaster, ABC, which is the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, which first aired the claims. Another Minister of Parliament, Dr. Andrew Lamming, accused over the weekend of upskirting and other inappropriate behavior towards female staff and constituents, has agreed to undergo empathy training. But it was the story told by a former young staffer to the government, her name Brittany Higgins, that first burst the bubble, shielding Canberra, which is the capital of Australia, and the several male ministers and staffers whose transgressive behaviors had been allowed to go unchecked. Higgins went public on February 15 with accusations that a senior colleague had raped her inside a government minister's office in March of 2019. Higgins, who was 24 years old at the time of the alleged rape, had said she did not receive adequate support after she reported the incident and that she was called a lying cow by then Defense Minister Reynolds. Now, the minister was forced to apologize and is to pay damages to Higgins. Since Higgins went public, three other women have come forward to accuse the same man of sexual assault or harassment. The accusations prompted the Prime Minister to deliver an emotional apology in which he credited his wife for giving him perspective. She said to me, "You have to think about this as a father. What would you want to happen if it were our girls?" Morrison told a press briefing. His remarks caused a public backlash and led Ms. Higgins to issue a statement saying that, quote, "the continuing victim-blaming rhetoric by the Prime Minister is personally very distressing to me and countless other survivors." In comments he made later, Morrison said he had been hearing stories in which he learned that men in power do not view women as equals. He said he had been listening carefully, quote-unquote, to female colleagues and friends, quote, about the issues and the traumatic things that they have had to deal with, end quote. Another quote, I've heard that women are overlooked, talked over by men, whether it is in boardrooms, meeting rooms, staff rooms, in media conferences, in cabinets, or anywhere else, he said. Many read the Prime Minister's messages as indicative of a political class out of touch with grievances of inequality, sexism, and casual misogyny, women say are systemic in politics. And one former Conservative Minister of Parliament, Julia Banks, went so far as to describe the workplace culture in Parliament House as the most unsafe in Australia. "It's a problem when men have to default to women to explain that rape is wrong and sexual harassment can destroy women's careers," Lumbee says of Morrison's admission he consulted his wife to better understand Higgins' rape allegations. "Women are not here to explain to men why this is wrong." Virginia Hausega says the collective action by women is a crystallizing moment affecting every single woman in Australia. This is about all of us, said Hal Sega, founder and chair of the 50-50 by 2030 Foundation at the University of Canberra. Quote, the profound failure of the Prime Minister and every minister in his cabinet to understand that point is frankly breathtaking. She said she could barely read some of the heartbreaking testimonials pouring out from women coming in texts, online posts, phone calls, and even official emails from the boss addressed to dear colleagues. And those who have shared their experience of discrimination, inappropriate behavior, and the seemingly pervasive toxic culture amid the conditions of power, the corridors of power in the capital, are among Australia's most senior and well-respected former and current politicians, including Conservative former Deputy and Foreign Minister Julia Bishop and Australia's youngest former elected Federal Minister Kate Ellis. Ellis, who in 2007 became the youngest serving federal minister at the age of 30, is the latest female former minister to reveal details of the harassment she was subjected to and is gathering stories from other women, politicians, for her book. The book will be called Sex, Lies, and Question Time. I'd only been a minister of parliament for a couple of weeks, and we were out for drinks, and this liberal conservative staffer quite aggressively just said, Kate, the only thing anyone wants to know about you is just how many blokes you effed in order to get this get into parliament. That's outrageous. Well, it looks like probably, I didn't realize it went over time. Let me quickly go back to our studio screen. Here he is, the man of the hour, or the man of the half hour. Good morning, Mr. Nolan. Forgive my lateness in picking you up. How are you?
Good morning. No problem.
Well, I really appreciate you calling. You know, we've talked about a lot of things that you have to bring and respond to the needs of people in Bronxville and people across the border in Yonkers. And I was wondering how you view the political environment in both Bronxville and Yonkers. They're very similar. They're predominantly conservative in thinking. And yet at the same time, for example, we find that the Yonkers government has many of them that were conservative at one time have switched parties for convenience because they think maybe the Democrats are the up-and-coming party to be with, and people might consider voting for an individual, even if they don't know their name, but just simply because they're a Democrat. Is there really a problem with that in the area that you want to represent? Because I don't think there is that issue, but I think it's an issue that might be interesting to discuss. I hope you would as well. How do you think about it?
I personally don't think it's an issue. I think it's becoming more and more that people are tired of party politics and they start to want to see the actual working person in there now. I firmly do believe that, you know, people are just tired of people reading the script that they know nothing about, and they start to put in people that are working class and know what it's like, that are outside the establishment, and, you know, to try and make sense of trying sick things.
Well, in a sense, your opposition, who is only in office for only one term at present, and she's a progressive Democrat, and I don't think that that sort of political perspective is conducive to the area that she's representing at present, that you hope to represent. And the fact that Mary Marvin, the mayor of Bronxville, has endorsed your campaign speaks to her conservative roots. And what's so interesting about Mary Marvin, I found her one of the first people, not because she was a woman, but the first person I ever met that was able to have a political agenda that she believed in And yet, at the same time, it didn't override the needs of the community she served. So politics was kept to the side. She believed what she believed, but she governed from a position of balance. And I get that impression from you. I didn't know you at all months and months ago, but I get that impression that you're balanced that way. Do you agree, or am I an idiot?
No.
I've been called
worse.
Yeah, I want you to know.
No. I find myself as balanced. I like to see myself as, you know, the person that's going to look at this situation from a whole. Like I said, when I am elected, I'm not going to go up there to play party politics. I'm going to do what's best for the people. So there are going to be times I have to stand my ground on certain things. There's going to be times I have to, you know, work with both sides of the aisle. But as long as it's in the best interest of the constituents and the cities, that's what comes first to me.
And when you think about that, politics is kept to the side. It's there. It's part of your demeanor. It's part of who you are. Those are your beliefs. But at the same time, the community in total, maybe predominantly they believe the same thing that you believe, but some will not. The responsibility of your being the Westchester County Board legislator is to respond to the needs of everyone in the district that you represent. So is that comfortable for you? Because a lot of people can't overcome the politics. They can't see beyond the trees. I get the impression you can. There's a simplicity in you and a complexity to you. I don't even think that you can appreciate, but I can. I see something very unique about you, which is really amazing. And it's rare to find someone like you getting into politics. What do you think some of the major issues are for the people in Bronxville and that section of Yonkers right across the border?
Well, thank you. And I actually am, you know, I'm comfortable. This is my home, and I've seen every side of Yonkers, and I look forward to making Bronxville a part of my home as well. The first thing is, you know, the quality of life. You know, we have a number of seniors here in Yonkers and in Bronxville that are being neglected. We have children resources that are being taken away more and more. And, you know, we just stop taking away from the future, especially COVID. Now it's made it even harder. And, you know, affordability. You know, we got to make sure that we stop raising taxes so much and banging on the taxpayers to get us out of a hole all the time. We got to make it more affordable. We got to be able to keep the money here and the people here, because sooner or later we're going to keep raising things and people are just going to get tired of it and move out. They're going to go to different places, which they already are, because it's just, you know, like they're looking at it from a whole as, well, if I'm paying for this, why am I not getting this type of life in return? So that's what it's really about, like on both sides. You know, like I said, the quality of life for our seniors, you know, the children, affordability, you know, infrastructure. You know, we have to, you know, look, the Bronx River, the Salt Mill is flooding all the time. We got, even with a budget problem, we have to find a way to fix that problem so that it doesn't get worse and worse. And those are situations that affect both Bronxville and Yonkers.
Mm-hmm. And then how do you discern these issues? Is it by talking to people and they say, well, what do you think is an issue? What do you think is a problem? Where do you think there's a deficiency of some sort about one program or another? Is that how you do it? You have to actually canvass the community?
I do. You know, I'm the type of person, I like to bring up random conversations with different people I meet or somebody I don't know just to get input. It's always good to hear, you know, somebody else's ideas and concerns, just so you can get an overall, like, mindset of what is going on. And that's how I go about it. You know, I like to hear from different people, you know, about just life in general, about what they're going through, what they worry about. And, you know, it's a great way to be.
It is. Well, one thing I noticed was Bronxville is a village of about, I think, short of 6,000 people. And when you come to Bronxville, they've got a vibrant city center, and they've got a great university there, which is regarded really as part of Yonkers. They like to say that they're in Bronxville. I guess they must think Bronxville has a greater cachet. But, you know, so it goes. And then when you cross the border into Yonkers, it's mostly residential. And yet they too somehow, I don't know, they balance each other out. Do most people in that section of Yonkers actually go to Bronxville to shop?
You know, we're the type of neighborhood and actual municipality that we like to go over to the other side and, you know, go shopping and just spend time, go eating, just, you know, taking in the sights. You know, it's good to venture out once in a while. But, you know, we have people from Bronxville that come over and do the same with us. Yeah, we have a big area up in Ridge Hill, up and down Central Avenue, with great facilities and businesses. And, you know, so I like the fact that, you know, people from Yonkers go to Bronxville, people from Bronxville come to Yonkers. It's needed. You know, it's a great way of life.
That is really cool. Really cool. It's a very interesting place. Both places, they've got some beautiful churches there as well. Oh, I forgot to mention, happy Easter to you and your family.
Thank you. Same to you.
Thank you. They've got some really beautiful places. We've got some great libraries. We've got churches as well. It just seems like a very, very comfortable and very well-heeled, not necessarily by money, but just well-heeled, comfortable people, middle class, maybe even higher. So a lot of the issues don't matter, but you've always been focused on the issues of seniors who are being neglected. How are we taking care of seniors now? Because I got the impression we're not. And, you know, the cost of housing seniors or even to do visiting nurses is falling apart. Do we yet know what the manner by which to respond population? I can't believe I'm getting old. I don't know. Is that supposed to be? Is that even allowed? I don't know.
Well, the aging right now through Westchester County, we have it through social services. And there are many situations, for example, you know, one couple, they filed for food assistance through county.
Uh-huh.
And both of them combined got approved for $16 a month in food. $16 a month
that's
for
it?
Two people. That's it. And that's sad.
Oh,
it really is, because our government is now failing them. We have to go back at the drawing board and look at what's going on. We need to reevaluate these things. You know, there's services that should be provided to people that really do need them. And, excuse me, you know, we have to look at it like that. We need to go back to the drawing board. You know, so there are things that assistance that is not being given, and we need to redetermine why, you know, and go back to the drawing board and look and say, hey, listen, what can we do to help our people? And honestly, that's what it's near and dear to my heart, because these seniors, they, you know, like, they've given so much and worked so hard their entire lives. You know, we have to help them now.
I can't even fathom why when they requested funding, they got $16 each. It's absolutely absurd. You know, what's fascinating is that the government hides all this stuff. Thank God you were able to recognize it, because then you could work on changing the dynamics. So much of the legislation and the conduct of government gets thrown to the side, and it gets buried under more and more government edicts, so that nobody really even knows what the government is doing. So it's all lost. I guess when you become elected, you're going to have to go through all that. list of stuff that they do. Can't believe
$16
a
day. You know, and that's
a burger.
Yeah,
that.
You know, and honestly, how do you expect people that are in their 70s, like, you know, especially during COVID? During COVID,
yeah.
when seniors could not get out, and I knew this firsthand, they were delivering groceries to seniors every other day.
Yeah.
You know, but mm-hmm. how do you expect people to survive on $16 a month combined?
I don't
You know,
it.
It's not even separate. You know, where it's $32. It's $16 a month. You know, and that's we have to look at, like, what are we doing? Like, where is this money going? Who are we assisting that doesn't need it, but who can we give it to that really does need it? And then, you know, we have to start to go back to the ground roots and, you know, start to actually care. You know, we have to stop making it harder for the people that deserve it and really need it and, you know, help them.
That's a good point you make, care. If we lost compassion, not just in politics, but in everything else, it doesn't seem we have enough compassion for what we do, the people we work with, the people we want to serve. And if we don't have that, then we have no interest. We have then no capacity to even think of a solution. It just seems we've become less and less than what I believed we used to be. Not that it was necessarily better, you know, in the year 2000 or the 1980s or the 1960s or before. But it just seems that we're doing less and we make believe that we're doing more. There's a lot of politicking that way. Self-promotion. So how do you keep people interested in your campaign other than talking on my radio show?
You know, I keep them interested. Like, it's hard right now because of COVID and the pandemic that we're still going through. So but we got to engage in different ways. So social media plays a big aspect in that for us.
Mm-hmm.
There's different talking points on there. So it starts like keeping our website updated. So that's how we really go about it. And then also when we can, you know, we do community service things like such as dropping off and donating PPE to areas that are needed. And then, you know, that's really where, you know, people see that, you know, we care. I care. This is my home.
Yeah.
I want to make a difference, and I will.
Right. What got you interested in politics in the first place?
You know, for my last 5.5 years after my brother passed away, you know, I really saw firsthand how there was a need in the community and how there were some people that were elected that, you know, they had the power to do things, they had the voice to do things, resources, and they just didn't do it. You know, so that's what really got me engaged and really wanted me to be involved because I want to make a difference. So, like, I'm the type of person that stopped asking why me and started asking why not me, you know. So that's the mindset I put forward. Because, like I said, I help advocate for legislation that was passed on many levels, statewide and municipalities. In the local area. So I wanted to take that approach and just try and make a difference, you know, where it needed.
I guess I think that's the only way you can get it done. Have you already planned? Well, I don't need to know your secrets because that's probably, you know, that's in your bag and you want to be able to present that when you get elected. But do you have concepts of things you want to change and do you see that it can make a difference already if you get elected?
Yes. You know, like it's going to be a battle. You know, just for the simple fact that if I am elected, that there are, 15 other Democrats that are up there pushing against me. Like, I'm going to be letting known from the beginning. I'm not going up there to be a tyrant. I'm going to go up there to do what's best for the people. And I am going to be willing to stand my ground every step of the way, but I will be able to reach across the aisle and extend the olive branch to let it be known that I work for the people. I'm doing this for the people.
Right.
I'm not doing this to do a back and forth because that's what we have too much of right now. So You know, so I have my my goals and my ambitions that I want to complete. Just like holding my ground on raising taxes, I will make sure I will not go as far as raising taxes because, you know, I just don't believe in it.
Well, those are important issues for sure. Do you end up going to visit like senior centers or hospitals that are doing that? I mean, do they even let you visit with COVID?
It's hard.
Moment?
Yeah, it's hard because of COVID, so many facilities won't let you in. I have donated PPE and food where they, you know, you could drop it off in the main lobby. But as far as going in, it's actually understandable why they won't let you in because of the patients and the residents
Absolutely.
That they have.
Right. Well, it needs to be that way.
Yeah.
In order to protect them and to protect yourself, too. You never know. You can pick up the virus from who knows. So very interesting. What are some of the stories of the older people that you bump into? What do they say? What do they want? What do they hunger for?
They just want to have a voice. They want to know that they have someone they could turn to. You know, there's so many people that feel that, you know, especially with COVID, that they didn't have anybody to turn to, that some elected officials went missing, you know, and that's something we can't do. We have to be, you know, out there. We have to help them as much as possible. If it was going door to door or sending people door to door to go check on seniors to see what their needs are. You know, these are problems that they, you know what, it's not so much to ask for. They just want to be heard. They want to know that, you know, well, listen, we have someone to turn to. You know, I remember I delivered groceries to a woman that didn't have food in her refrigerator for 3 days because her home health aide just stopped showing up. You know, that's horrible. You know, and she had a disease. You know, she had an illness, and she couldn't get out. You know, so these are things that we should be doing more of. And, you know, taking care of them and helping them. Because, you know what, I don't like the fact that election time, people go knocking around and stuff like that, and then all of a sudden it's election time, they're nowhere to be found now, the elected officials or the candidates.
We need to
be out there all the time. We have to be out there. Even when I am elected, I want to make sure that I am knocking 7, 8 months, maybe a year after the election, on doors to see what their constituents, what their concerns are, what their worries are, if they have any advice. You know, I want to be out there. I want to be noticeable, and I'm gonna be.
Yeah. Well, I understand. I'm really quite in shock that woman didn't have food for 3 days, and was she too feeble to call, or maybe she had no one that she could call.
Yeah, she didn't know who to call, who to contact about it. And it just so happened she happened to see it on Facebook that we were doing food drives and groceries and things like that. So I got a message from somebody asking me, would you mind going over? So I went right over and dropped it off. It was right off McLean Avenue. And you know what? The woman was in tears because she said it. She said, my home health aide stopped showing up. She doesn't know why.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's the biggest thing I've been hearing, that older seniors in their 80s and 90s and have home health care, they get lost somehow. I don't know why. The caretakers are gone after a few days. Nobody seems to know. We evidently are missing some sort of a rule book for the people who have these services. And it's probably very simple to do, but no one's done it. You know, just to say where to go or just who to call. You know, so that you can get some sort of action. And God help us, they need food too. That's amazing. we don't, you know, like I know at the church near where I live, every day or every other day they have food deliveries. But you also have to be, you need to be able to walk. You need to be able to get there. You need to be able to being pretty fit sometimes to pick up all this stuff.
Yeah.
And I don't know if these a lot of these seniors are too old and physically incapable of even taking enough food home. It's it really is amazing. The system has failed. So that's one of the issues you're going to be tackling when you get elected, I would think.
Yes, you know, like, you know, I know it's going to be a battle, and I know people are going to, well, what about the money? Listen, there's money that is spent in places that we shouldn't, and we'll find it. And you know what? Then there's going to be ways that we can get stuff done. Just for an example, like, we have a number of grants that are given out to Westchester County to nonprofits. I personally feel that this past year of COVID, that, you know what, we should have reallocated that money to necessary and essential programs like food distribution, shelter, education programs, or even something like a domestic violence nonprofit, so that the most essential things that were taken care of. Or, you know what, listen, we were going to continue to give grants from the previous year. We should, they gave 2% raises. We shouldn't have given those raises. We should have said, okay, that additional 2% we're going to give you, we're going to allocate to somewhere else that is needed. Because that, meant, that could help go a long way. That could help provide food for a senior or for a family. You know, it could help go a long way. But I am looking forward to addressing the issue as much as possible. And when I'm up there, I encourage other elected officials to work with me. Because, you know what, it could be their parents, it could be their grandparents, it could be their neighbors that need it. So this is what we really have to do it for. We have to do it for the people.
I appreciate your sensitivity to, you know, abuse of seniors. Their own children actually can hurt them. And they're embarrassed and they're too pained to even bring it about. Do we have programs for seniors to talk about, you know, physical, even sexual abuse?
Not that I know of, but that's definitely something that we should look into and encourage more, because it's definitely needed. You know, there's no reason why someone should become a victim, especially young or a senior, you know, nobody. So that is definitely something that should be brought up and developed.
Yeah, it does seem that we've forgotten the very old. I don't think of myself as old yet. I'm 71, but even so, I think of people older, in their 80s and 90s. They're more frail and they don't always have security in walking and doing a lot of other things. So they get shut in, but they're abused by their own relatives, which is, I would never even imagine doing something like that, but evidently it's happening. I think that's very positive of you to even consider and think about that. Well, unfortunately, we're getting to the end of our time. We've only got about 90 seconds left. How do people reach out to you if they want to support your campaign?
Well, you can always reach out to us on my website. The messages get directed back to me at electjamesnolan.com. Also, we can be emailed at electjamesnolan2021@gmail.com. And then those messages go directly to me and my team.
Mm-hmm. That is great. Well, again, I want to thank you. Can't wait till we speak again. There's so much on the table that isn't discussed. So thanks for braving the unknown world for a lot of people. I appreciate it, Mr. Nolan. Thank you very much.
No problem. Take care.
Oh, and happy Easter. All the best.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you. Take care. Well,
bye.
There we are, folks. That's the end of our day for today, and we'll speak to you tomorrow. Thank you very much, and goodbye. Where are we here? God.